Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown's taken another step towards a presidential bid in the wake of a successful bid for re-election to the Senate in November. The Democrat announced last week that he will visit four early primary states in the coming weeks in what he calls a dignity of work tour. Brown said he'll decide on a presidential run when that tour wraps up in March. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Good morning.
Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, welcome back.
Good morning, Ann.
And Columbus Dispatch State Government Reporter Jim Siegel, welcome back. We're double teaming it from the dispatch today.
Yes, double dispatch. Very exciting.
two dispatch in one. All right, so this is a pretty standard process that Sherrod Brown is embarking on right now. That's kind of the going out and just kind of dipping his toe in the waters in these early primary states, right, Daryl? It's nothing unusual.
Sure. I mean, the news this morning as we record this show is that Kamala Harris has become the third U.S. senator to enter the race. I've seen lists for Democrats. There are 5,000 Democrats considering running. The debates will be interesting, everything. Senator Brown, frankly, he's been in public office virtually all of his adult life. He's 66 years old. He has won a key battleground state three times now. He won by 6 points in a state Trump carried by 8. If he's ever going to consider doing this in his lifetime, it's got to be now. It's got to be this year. That's not saying he is or he isn't. It's basically testing the waters. It's interesting. He's tried out this dignity of work theme.
It doesn't roll off the tongue, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see how that test drives across the nation, or at least in these first four states. And, of course, it's Iowa who holds the first caucus, New Hampshire holds the first primary, then South Carolina and Nevada. So those are the first four early voting states. He's going to be actually kicked us off in Cleveland on next week. Uh-huh. Then the next day he's going to Iowa first. And as far as I've heard, none of the other three have been scheduled. But you're right, soon, and then a decision in March. Because, you know, I know people are sick of this from the last time, but it's getting late, actually. If you want in this race, raising money, getting your name known, all that good stuff.
You know, he said in the announcement that Democrats on a national level too often see the messaging either has to go to progressives or to the kind of the blue collar ilk of the party. You can't do both at the same time. Andy Chow, it sounds like he's trying to kind of create more of a hybrid Democrat now.
And I think that's exactly why he's kind of jumping into the mix right now, because I think he thinks he has a message that no other Democrat is bringing to the table. Like Daryl said, he was able to win in Ohio, a state that swung very much towards Trump in 2016. So he's got that going for him. But he does have this message, that this narrative that he's been working on for a decade or two now, trying to reach out to labor groups, towards the working class, people who tend to be registered as Democrats but fall on the moderate side. But he thinks that this kind of message that appeals to those people also appeals to progressives. And so he is trying to find a good mix between people who might vote for Trump and maybe people who would vote for somebody like Bernie Sanders. And I think he's trying to straddle that line.
Yeah.
And he's also trying to offer up the alternative to Trump, and that the criticism that Trump is a fake populism. Mm-hmm. He's trying to offer up real populism, a real message, and someone who really cares about the working class. It's obviously a group of voters that Democrats lost in 2016, which is why Donald Trump is now president. They lost it in the Midwest, that's why Donald Trump was able to win in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. Can Sherrod Brown bring those folks back into the fold, as I hear described? The Democrats need those voters who shower after work, not before work, and Sherrod Brown knows how to speak to those folks. Sherrod Brown will not go out on a tour and talk about the Me Too movement and whether immigrants should be treated like everybody else, or whether what pronoun to use when describing someone. Those are the kind of things that tend to turn off those kind of voters. And he's going to get down to what he thinks really matters to all sides on the Democratic side, which is jobs and wages and being given a fair shot to move up the economic ladder.
And I think what Jim said might. Like that might bother some progressives or liberal voters who say, well, I want to hear about the Me Too movement. I want to hear about immigration. But, when we would go out and interview people in more of the rural Ohio areas, and I would talk to them, and they would be Trump supporters, and I would talk to them about why they supported Trump, they would say, well, I was a Democrat for most of my life, but the Democratic Party left me. And you would hear that them repeat
those. You hear Republicans say the same thing about the Republican
Party,
though. Yeah,
and then you ask them, well, why? And then they pick maybe one issue that they say they disagree with the Democrats on. So for this one person, it was abortion. With other people, it was more of this. They didn't like the PC culture or anything like that. So, these more of these social issues where they do agree on these other fiscal issues and labor issues. So I do think there's a huge crop of people out there who would vote for a Democrat if they did scale back on the narrative when it comes to the social issues like Me Too and abortion and focused on the other issues like the economy, infrastructure and labor.
Interestingly enough, the Republican campaigns against Sherrod Brown have all been he's too liberal for Ohio. That is now being turned on its head as he competes in a Democratic primary. And you see criticism is he's not liberal enough. He does not support, for instance, Medicare for all or a Bernie Sanders like, health care plan, things that are on the entire left end of the political spectrum. And, in a primary, so often it is the hardcore people on the left or on the right that decide it. So we'll see if, a lot of this is going to depend on how many people, survive, say, the next 6 months in terms of fundraising and all of that. This is a bit of a mirror image of what the Republicans went through in 2015, leading up to the 2016 race with that massive field. And you remember we had the debate and who got to make the main stage, who got to sit at the kids' table
right,
undercard debate and all that stuff. I mean, the Democrats could have a room full of kids' tables at this one. Key to Sherrod Brown, I should say, as we're talking about debates, is the criteria for Republicans was all about polling. Right now you look at the national poll, Sherrod Brown is down among the also-rans, obviously Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Beto's up there. He's certainly the flavor of the month or of the past 6 months. Mm-hmm. Sherrod Brown does not nearly have the national profile of that, or, Elizabeth Warren, even Kamala Harris, who made her name during the confirmation hearings for Justice Kavanaugh.
Right.
But it also, supposedly the criteria are going to include fundraising, things like that. Sherrod Brown's a very good fundraiser. Now, he shot his wad, a lot of it, and obviously he just got reelected for a third term. But he never stopped fundraising. So if he could do that on a national scale, that will gain him credibility, because money pretty much always talks in politics.
But I think he's got that fundraising is coast to coast. Mm-hmm. It's not just Midwest or the West Coast or the East Coast.
But I think Darrow's right. It's an uphill battle because I think ever since 2008 with Barack Obama, and then we definitely saw in 2016 with Donald Trump, that there's sort of like two crops of candidates who run for office. You have these maybe more political wonks, these people who are longtime public servants. And then there are these sort of government celebrities and people who have maybe a lot of social media followers. Kamala Harris is somebody who makes a name for herself by having these huge moments during confirmation hearings, things that start to go viral when she during like cross examinations and stuff like that. She's been able to build a name for herself that way.
Has a solid background as a prosecutor and,
Right. She has the public service background, but then she also has that little extra something that has gone viral in the past and that's created name recognition. You're totally right.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if Sherrod Brown has that too, if he's had that moment yet where something's gone viral and a lot of people have followed it. I know last year he gave a speech on the Senate floor talking about the tax deal and saying that it's not going to go well. This is what's going to happen. And a year later, a lot of the things that he laid out have actually happened. So, and I wonder if because we're from Ohio, if maybe we're just too close to it and we don't know how he sort of ranks nationally.
Well, his haircut went viral, didn't it?
Yeah.
And his ad with his dog, Lincoln.
That's right.
It's got all the makings.
Franklin. Franklin, not Lincoln.
Franklin. He
wouldn't be named after a Republican,
I was
right?
going to say. He wouldn't be Lincoln.
You know, it is. We're how many months out now? With 2 years out, basically, from the inauguration of a new inauguration of the current president or the inauguration of a new president.
Right. We're right at halftime.
We're right at halftime now, which used to be halftime, and now it feels like the last quarter, considering the speed with which politics moves these days. Did the Democrats, do you think, learn anything from, given their positioning now, learn anything from that Republican experience? With the big kids and the little kids table?
Well, yeah, I think that's one reason they're talking about the criteria to qualify for the main stage, if you will, for the debates, being more about just a popularity contest early on. I mean, we're talking about debates in just a few months.
Right.
So these folks haven't really had much of a chance to campaign. So if you just do it, it's going to be a total name recognition game, which is why Donald Trump wound up in the center of the first debate at Cleveland in August, I believe, of 2015, and was there for every ensuing debate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was very unpopular in many quarters.
But he was very well known.
But he was very well known. And, you know, okay, yeah, Donald Trump and then Jeb Bush and Chris Christie and, you know, where are all these other people now?
Well, there's
no Democratic equivalent to Donald Trump when in terms of being a personality and a celebrity the way he was when he started. I mean, you know, his years of The Apprentice was basically a 6 year advertising campaign for him, as you know, portraying him as a strong businessman and a straight talker. And so, you know, people, and even before that, with his other appearances elsewhere, I mean, he was a showman as much as a businessman, and he has continued to be. You know, nobody doubts his marketing abilities most of the time. But Democrats don't have anybody like that. They have some names that are definitely more recognizable than others. You know, your Elizabeth Warrens and such, but they're completely in the political scene, and that's a completely different. Level of being known than it is if you come in from outside as a celebrity and can pick up popularity that way.
And Ann, you mentioned, you asked, have the Democrats learned from the Republicans in 2016? But I think another big question that a lot of progressives and Democrats would also be wondering if have Democrats learned from their own lessons in 2016? Because a big drama on their side was the delegates versus superdelegates. And a lot of people were upset with the process when it comes to superdelegates, mm-hmm. feeling like Bernie Sanders never had a chance because of that process. And the DNC, voted to reduce the role of superdelegates. So we are going to see a very different process this next time around when it comes to how the Democrats pick a nominee.
Hmm. And the timing of the Sherrod Brown tour is the shutdown at the federal level is this a good time to be talking about dignity of work? It seems propitious.
Well, Sherrod Brown is a very skilled politician, and I'm sure he will be able to work federal shutdown into a message that resonates.
He's already spoken out against the shutdown.
Yes. I mean, and for Democrats, frankly, it's not, you know,
it's a no-brainer.
It's really not that hard for them to speak about the shutdown because they have a legit argument that it's not their shutdown. And if for no other reason than Donald Trump said, it's my shutdown. And, you know, he's the one who won't sign a bill to reopen the government. I have no doubt he'll be able to work that in. I mean, dignity of work can easily be transformed into, which also includes our federal workers who aren't being paid right now.
Mm-hmm.
They are not experiencing dignity, and he will argue it's because of the president.
And it goes, you know, former Governor Kasich makes a point about Donald Trump's success about appealing to workers who felt like they've been bypassed. They don't feel like they're important. You know, no one cares about them. So I think this is Sherrod Brown's attempt to say, you know, what you do matters. And that means you matter. You know, dignity of work. As you say, it does seem like he needed a branding team, maybe something a little different. But he traces it back to, and you know, it's very appropriate to say this today, to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You know, the phrase originated, you know, more than 50 years ago. in the civil rights movement. So he can apply that to minority relations. And, you know, those sanitation workers where Dr. King went to Memphis to identify with, you know, okay, you're garbage workers, but there's a dignity in your work, dignity in doing your job well. You should be recognized. You should be paid adequately. And, you know, you should have a seat at the table as well. And a lot of folks vote for Donald Trump because they don't feel like that they have a seat at the table. So if Sherrod Brown can use it to make that pivot in favor of the Democrats, then, you know, we'll look back on that and say, boy, that was really smart.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Darrell Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, and also Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment today, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Our guests, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Darrell Rowland, and Columbus Dispatch State Government Reporter Jim Siegel. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Governor DeWine is opened his administration, I guess, with a typical bang, it seems, leading an Ohio delegation to a meeting in Detroit with General Motors CEO Mary Barra to talk about the soon-to-be-shuttered Lordstown plant. Now, he asked her for help in finding a new tenant. I guess it's not that unusual to do this kind of a thing. It's kind of putting your best foot forward, sort of, Darrell Rowland, but with, you know, lackluster results at best.
Yeah, then candidate DeWine promised to do this before the election, and indeed, first week he's in office, he does so. I mean, that coincided with the Detroit Auto Show. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the expectations were going in. The Ohio delegation, you know, Rob Portman, Sherrod Brown, Jim Renacci, I'm sure others have met with, you know, the top officials at GM, you know, say, number one, keep the plant open, don't shut it down. Number two, if you're going to remove the crews from there, give us another line. Or number three, if you're just abandoning it, help us find another tenant, whether it's Tesla or something we haven't even heard of. And GM has just not given anybody any assurances of anything. Apparently, they've been friendly and talked nice, but at the end of the day, you know, the new governor got pretty much what all the existing Ohio politicians have gotten. It, you know, no promises.
Right.
And so now it's scheduled to shut down here in just a couple of months.
Right.
And I happen to live about a mile from that plant for about a year of my life. And boy, is that talk about a heartbeat of that entire area. But that's just been so hollowed out. We were down to one shift now. And I was running three shifts, you know, not all that long ago. So, but to lose those last 1,600 workers, so good paying jobs in that area, that is a huge blow to an area that really can't afford it.
Right. Right. He also he has started a new commission, I guess, to advise him on it's a council, I guess, to advise the governor's office on mental illness, substance abuse prevention, treatment and recovery services in Ohio. And it sounds to me like Andy Chow, aren't there already cabinet level agencies that do that?
Yeah, this is something that the state government has already been doing in the past. It's like a blue ribbon task commission. This is something that Mike DeWine did when he was attorney general as well, that he created different task forces and different commissions to tackle things. And I think he's found that it works for him. You're right. There are already people who have been on this issue for a while now. But I think to him, it seems like the way he's been structuring his own administration is to create different commissions to streamline the specific problems that he wants to address. So right out of the gate, he created the commission on home visitations to help with his child initiatives project. And then this is Recovery Ohio, where this is going to streamline the opioid crisis. And so, yeah, there have been people who have been talking about this for a while, but this sort of puts a lot of big names on the group to sort of lend voice to the issue.
Including former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland's on the panel, as well as former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Evelyn Stratton. And so, yeah, there are people who are going to sort of be the face of this issue as well, I think, to the face of the people who are tackling this issue head on.
What about funding for these kinds of things? Again, I always think, well, there's already agencies in place. Who funds this? How does it work, Darrell Rowland? I'm not sure that John Kasich did much of this.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I don't think these are paying positions. I could be wrong. I
think they pay for gas and travel and stuff like that, but I don't think they get a salary for doing the things that they're going to do.
Right. I think they were... I mean, most of these folks are professionals in their field who, you know, most of us have never heard of, but they're probably very competent on these issues. Eve Stratton, Justice Stratton, former Justice Stratton, has made a name for herself in the mental health field for decades now, and mental health courts and things like that. She's very well versed on that issue.
What about Governor Strickland?
Former Governor Strickland was a psychologist.
Oh, that's right.
You know, mainly in the prison system, so... again, you're talking about that sort of the mental health end of attacking the opioid crisis. Those are two names, but they're not just token well-known names. They do bring some qualifications to the table. And boy, here's one break from the Kasich administration. He would not have appointed Governor Strickland to anything.
Right.
Not even a dog catcher commission.
Not the dog catcher, right.
That animosity. So, you know. In that case, Governor DeWine has reached out. And if we're going to talk about the changes, the executive orders, he maintained Governor Kasich's sort of belated order on rights for the transgender state employees. That was something that DeWine I'd have to say most observers would categorize that as a surprise, maybe a big surprise. He opposed very strenuously when the Obama Department of Education, I think the Justice Department was in on that as well, basically mandated to local school districts, including one here in Ohio that sued. It's up to the student. It's up to the student for, according to their gender identity, by their choice, which restroom or shower facility, locker room, what have it, to do that. DeWine went to court to oppose that. So it was kind of a surprise. But he told my colleague Randy Ludlow, well, basically, times are changing, and he wants Ohio to be attractive to all workers.
He not only carried out the anti-discrimination policy, like Daryl's right, Kasich only added gender identity to the list
after
maybe a month
ago. After he put the kibosh on it when he first took office.
Seven and three-fourths years, basically.
Yeah, and then at the very end, reinstituted it.
So DeWine not only carried that out, and continued it, but he added other people as protected classes, including pregnant women, parents of young children, and foster parents. So he expanded the list of protected classes under the state government employment.
Do you think that mitigated any pushback on that issue by including those other classes?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I know there's folks opposed to it, but I have not heard any great outcry that these protections have been... Continue. If you look at public opinion polling, first of all, gay rights, transgender
rights.
Times
have changed.
That has shifted radically. I don't care where you stand on this issue. It's shifted radically in the last 10, 15, 20 years in this country, certainly in this state. And even those who would say oppose same-sex marriage still are more in favor of saying, well, we shouldn't discriminate, however. In terms of, rights and things like that. And that does Ohio enact something like that as a general law for housing and employment and things like that to protect sexual orientation and, gender identity and things of that nature. That would be much more controversial.
And I think it also reduces the backlash because the scope is so limited to state government. Had it pertained to businesses, private businesses, people would be out there worried that it might be related to religious organizations, religious affiliated organizations. So because it's just state government, I think that changes things too.
Yeah, I think while the legislature has started to maybe soften a little bit on this issue, I would be surprised if they softened enough to actually want to move ahead with any legislation protecting these folks.
Because there is state level, statewide level.
Right, yeah. Because there is legislation that comes up every General Assembly. It's been dubbed the Ohio Fairness Act now, and it never goes anywhere. This last General Assembly was the first time it had gone anywhere, had any movement in about 10 years, because it not only had a sponsor testimony in committee, but it also had proponent testimony. Because there's a huge group of there's a group filled with businesses who want to see this now. Lots of different chambers of commerce around Ohio are supporting it now because they say that it makes Ohio more attractive to businesses outside of Ohio.
Right. You know, with the potential, I guess, the changing makeup, if you will, of the Ohio General, I should say the Ohio House, with the election of Larry Householder as Speaker of the House and the deals he cut with Democrats, giving them subcommittee assignments and that kind of a thing. Jim Siegel, does it have a chance to make it any farther this time around?
No.
No.
Yeah. Not because of any of that. I mean, look, the vast majority of, I'm guessing, of the Republicans who backed Larry Householder for Speaker, they are among the most conservative members of that caucus, and I would be shocked if any more than a handful of them would support such a thing. A subcommittee has no power. A subcommittee is below a regular standing committee and generally is used to investigate issues and make recommendations to the actual committee. They don't amend bills. They don't send bills to the floor. The Democrats will be able to engage more in the discussion of some issues, but that doesn't mean at the end of the day that they'll have the ability to actually move things or decide not to move things through the chamber.
You wrote about how women are going to dominate the new Democratic caucus in the House. It's half of the Democratic caucus in the House is female.
Yes. There's a record number of women now been elected to the Ohio House. I believe it's 28 total. 19 of those are Democrats, which I believe makes 19 of 38. I believe by my math is half.
I think.
And now that they're basically after the election of Larry Householder as Speaker, this was done by getting 26 Democratic votes and 26 Republican votes for Householder, and basically. The current minority leader, Fred Strayhorn, first he wanted the Democrats to support him for Speaker. When they said, no, we're not going to do that, he said, okay, well, then we should back Ryan Smith. And more than two-thirds of them said, no, we're not going to do that either. And let's face it, a leader whose members don't follow him is not a leader anymore, particularly when you're in the minority and all you are is, you're largely the face and the voice of the caucus. If you don't represent the caucus anymore, then there's no point in staying. So Fred Strayhorn is going to step down. We're going to get a new leadership team. Both members of leadership that voted for Smith are going to be out, replaced by Representative Amelia Sykes is going to be the new minority leader. Representative Kristen Boggs will be the assistant minority leader. And then you'll have Kent Smith, the male left on the panel. And then we'll have a freshman out of Akron.
Paula Hicks Hudson.
Paula Hicks Hudson. I'm sorry, out of Toledo.
I looked it up right before we got here.
Freshman in leadership.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's minority leadership.
Minority, yeah.
So it definitely shows there is a growing female presence in the Ohio House.
Among Democrats, though, is it?
Mostly among Democrats, yeah. I mean, look, 9 of 61 Republicans are women. That is not a... I don't think anything to get too excited about.
Right.
We'll wait and see if that translates into anything.
Mm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Just quickly, I brought up the government shutdown a few minutes ago, and I wanted to follow it just a little bit more. Kathy Kandisky of the Dispatch wrote that it's triggered a big increase in claims for unemployment compensation. Is this the only way that Ohio is really being affected, or is it going to matter much in the long run? Daryl Rowland?
Well, the second part of your question, of course, is I mean, we talk about the impact on the long run, sure.
How long is the long run, right?
Right, because, I mean, now we have food stamps being distributed now. They're supposed to last you through February. But my understanding is if nothing changes and that shutdown goes that far, then that could be it. We have TSA workers working without pay. They have for several weeks now, obviously. I heard other news reports that over this weekend was the biggest round of absentee call-ins of TSA workers. Again, folks out at John Glenn, the old Port Columbus, say not really affected us that much here. I mean, there's all sorts of things. Food inspections, federal grants, federal contractors such as Battelle, things of that nature. The weird thing is it's a partial government shutdown. For instance, Columbus's biggest presence, out there on East Broad Street, with the Defense Supply Center Columbus and Defense Finance Accounting Services and things like that, are deemed quote unquote essential employees, is my understanding, for the most part, anyhow. Mm-hmm. So they are working as normal. So as far as employees, but services, the longer it goes, the more you're going to see a real life impact.
Let's take a break here. We will continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, where he's public affairs editor. Also with us, Jim Siegel, Dispatch state government reporter, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable on this, the national holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor Daryl Rowland, and Columbus Dispatch State Government Reporter Jim Siegel. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim Siegel, you wrote about this some years ago. It's the issue of how charter schools pay their leases and to whom. It's been followed up with an audit by former state auditor Dave Yost. It's one of the last acts before he became a state attorney general. What did it tell us?
Well, it basically told us that at least on the charter schools he looked at, they're paying way more for their facilities than the market says they should be paying. And in a couple of those cases, particularly those facilities being operated by Imagine schools and the National Heritage Academies, those are for-profit operators. The school leases with those two are particularly high because they are it's a complex situation. They're basically leasing their buildings from an affiliate of their for-profit management companies, and they're doing it at pretty high rates.
It's a real estate affiliate.
It's a real estate affiliate, yeah. And so, it's a problem because charter schools don't have a lot of money up front when they start to get facilities. The state, one of the concerns is that the state just doesn't provide enough money for facilities for charter schools. So they're having to go through these creative ways to kind of come up with a lease to find a building. And, school buildings are not, always readily available very often. And so, but the problem is that, as the auditor is pointing out, is that, you've got some lax oversight, lax state laws, and some weak school boards that are leading to these taxpayers are flat out just getting ripped off. I mean, they're paying there's one Cincinnati charter school right now paying about $867,000 over market value for its buildings.
How are these charter schools justifying this?
Well, they're saying, look, their management companies are just saying these are we worked out good deals with them, and this is the deals we made with the market at the time, I mean, it's, you know, but the numbers are what they are. Mm-hmm. This isn't a total problem with just the charters. There is a state funding component to this that is an issue.
How so?
Well, just like I said, we only provide about $200 per pupil.
Oh, I see what you mean.
For buildings. And that, according to some experts, is about a quarter of what is the actual cost. So, but
market rate's the market rate.
Right. That's why. And that's the problem on their side is it really looks like that these for-profit management companies are getting richer, making money off of these charter schools by charging them exorbitant leases and in turn having a lot of taxpayer money that should be going to educating kids is ending up in these what are basically real estate companies that are run mm-hmm. by these charter school operators. And so that's a problem. And in some cases – and they're finding – and he also compared it to a handful of other schools that do not have these agreements and what they're paying for facilities. And they're finding that these schools that he looked at with these management companies are paying 2 to 3 times as much as a percentage of their revenue toward their leases as these other schools.
And they tend to be poor for-profit, whereas the nonprofits, that isn't tending to be the case.
Right. And it's because of this weird – I mean there was one school he looked at. They were leasing through a subsidiary of Imagine Schools. Well, then they dropped Imagine Schools as their management company and instead then redid the lease directly with the owner of the property, which was a real estate trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the price dropped mm-hmm. on the lease like 26% just by doing that. I mean, nothing else about the lease changed. They just cut out a middleman that the charter school operator was affiliated with, and immediately the price dropped a couple $100,000 a year.
You know, we've known about these kinds of transactions for a number of years, not the least of which because
yes.
you wrote about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Andy Chow, I mean, why hasn't this popped up on the legislature's list of things to do when it comes to oversight of charter schools in Ohio?
I think this is one of the hardest things to cover because it's not a secret, and you just have to wonder why. I mean, the legislators know about this. This question kind of came up when it comes to equipment.
Right.
It comes up when it comes to any kind of capital
expenditure.
And like this idea of, well, there's an operator box and a management company box and then the leasing company, but then the management company owns the leasing company, like, and just all this money trading hands that wind up back to the management company. This is something that we've heard of for years now. I will say that the legislature in the past couple of years has finally started to take a serious approach to regulating charter schools.
Is this issue among?
I think this is one of the things that does come up. But you know, when it goes through the committee process, you might start with a big comprehensive bill that increases oversight, and then little by little, there might be amendments that are chipped away. I'm trying to remember if a couple years ago we had House Bill 2 that was a big step towards more regulation. But this is, I'm sure, going to be something that's next on the list. Former State Senator Joe Schiavone from Youngstown has been talking about this issue for a while now. He's not with the legislature anymore, but these are the types of issues that the Democrats have been bringing up for a couple of years now.
Hmm. So, Daryl Roland, I mean, is there any pressure anymore on the Ohio General Assembly to address a lot of these shortcomings of oversight of charter schools now that, say, the big, you know, ECOTs folded?
That's a great question. It's kind of a moving dynamic. As Andy mentioned, the big reform effort, at least in recent history, was Senate Bill 2, right? House Bill mm-hmm. 2, my bad. These guys actually cover the legislature. I just, you know, I just sit back and relax most of the day. Yeah. whether they have, you know, and that was, on the one hand, that was seemingly elementary stuff to many folks, basic stuff. And that was a bit of a challenge to get through. I mean, it did get through eventually. Interestingly, this audit was done by Dave Yost as not part of any regular auditing function.
Nothing complaint. Apparently triggered it?
Well, it was done in the public interest, as I recall. Is that, Jim, phraseology you recall?
He explain how he chose these charter schools?
It is in the audit, and it's almost like this is way oversimplifying, but I would almost say likely suspects.
Okay.
And again, Jim and Kathy Kandisky I've written about this before with, I know, the Imagine Schools, who have facilities here in Columbus. It is tough. I mean, again, the premise of charter schools is we're going to let you guys try a different alternative to education, and we're not going to regulate you as much as the public schools. And public school advocates say that's worked out well because you remove the regulation. Now we have all these abuses, as we saw with ECOT, making off with, you know, at least whatever, $80 million in 2 or 3 years, who knows how much going into past years, and all the kids that never really got an education there. Now we have this issue. You know, it's a huge philosophical divide in the legislature. But you're right, Democrats have brought this up, and voters seemingly have not responded to it. So that's the ultimate pressure.
A couple other things to remember. Mike DeWine, when he was campaigning to be governor, said that he would like to take a closer issue or a closer look at the issue of charter school funding, following the money and attaching it more towards performance. And so there might be some more oversight in place that's supported by now Governor DeWine. But on the other end of things, you got to remember that Larry Householder is now Speaker of the House. He was a huge supporter of ECOT and for-profit charter schools, avidly so. So who knows if he might be able to put the brakes on those types of reforms.
And John Husted, a lieutenant governor, also a huge supporter of charter schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Dave Yost laid out a couple of problems that he thinks legislators should be addressing, such as the bidding process. There's not a law that applies to charter schools when they are seeking to do facilities, that they have to go through a bidding process. That he pointed out the lack of facilities funding from the state, that mm-hmm. there's these conflicts of interests where the management companies own these, you know, real estate companies that are doing the leases and have no interest. You know, there's a clear conflict of interest there. If you're kind of running you're running the school and the school is trying to make a deal with basically you to rent the facilities. And another problem is the school boards are weak in many of these cases, that they're just they pointed out to the National Heritage schools and he said, you know, across many National Heritage schools, there were clearly minimal negotiations done because the leases are all very, very similar. And so clearly the school boards were just rubber stamping whatever National Heritage came up with in terms of the leasing agreement. And frankly, some of the management agreements with the schools actually say in them that we are the ones that are responsible for finding you school buildings. And so, again, that may not be a bad thing, except when that management company then has a direct financial interest in how much is being paid to on the lease.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about state legislators serving as attorneys for any of these firms. I thought I read some years ago that, for example, I think it was at that time State Senator Keith Faber was an attorney for one of these charter schools. If we're seeing such things in finances, what are we doing to monitor the connection between state legislators and these charter schools, and why is that not a conflict of interest?
I don't know about Keith Faber representing a charter school as an attorney.
No, I don't know either. But I mean, there are, you know,
there are
lawmakers would be unwise to directly involve themselves as lawyers in cases involving whatever school or charter school. It doesn't mean their firm may get involved, mm-hmm. And they should try to do something to keep them out of it, to keep themselves out of it. Mm-hmm. There are but that's a almost a case by case target as to when do you cross ethical boundaries in the legislature. There's sometimes you think maybe they are, but they don't, and it gets close. There is one new lawmaker who just joined the Republican ranks, Representative Jamie Callender. He was a
who used to be mm-hmm. in the Ohio House, at least, right?
Yeah, he's coming
for a little
back
bit and he's returning.
Okay. He's a bounce back. He's returning, but he was a direct attorney for some of these e-schools. And was involved directly in the negotiations and the lawsuits involving the Department of Education. So we'll see. But I don't know that he's still involved in any of that, but he was mm-hmm. at one time.
Charlotte's right. There are cases of conflicts of interest that do pop up every once in a while. I remember a couple of years ago when the legislature was working on the Great Lakes Compact, which deals with how much water you can pull out of Lake Erie. Mm-hmm. The sponsor of the bill is somebody who owned a water bottling company or who was a big part of a water bottling company.
Well,
so.
There are people who are life insurance, you know, that sell insurance, that work on insurance committees. There are mm-hmm. people that are into aviation, that
pharmacists who work on medical types of legislation.
Yeah. The question is there a direct link? That's the question. I want to move on just briefly. The new Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, wants to modernize the voter roll removal process, very controversial voter roll removal process. Now, I thought the process did just get modernized, and that's what former Secretary of State John Husted's been defending all these years.
Yeah, and when you talk to all these people, I think you begin to realize that when they say modernize, it's just a nice word of saying
change.
let's make this better, because it's not
in their opinion better.
Yeah. So I think what he's really trying to go for, what Frank LaRose is really trying to go for, is let's try to make it as hard as possible to remove somebody from the voter roll. So let's try to find a bunch of other ways to notify somebody. Right now, if somebody is an inactive voter, then they get something sent in the mail to an address to say, hey, you're gonna be removed if you don't start voting or update your information. And so to Husted's argument, the former Secretary of State, he would say it's modernized because now you can update your information online. There are other ways to update your information. Mm-hmm. But LaRose is saying let's try to get people where they're at. So if they go to the BMV, let's make it an opt-out process rather
Which
than
is key.
An uh-huh. And then there's all sorts of other times that people interact with state government. LaRose is saying, hey, when they're doing this or that, why not ask them, hey, by the way, you should update your voter information.
Mm. Yeah, and I understand what John Husted was doing, and you know, and wanting to keep the rolls clear of people who have moved multiple times and haven't notified them, and folks who are either, you know, whoever just aren't voting anymore. But I mean, look, I got a letter at my house a few weeks, you know, number of weeks ago. On one of these last notices addressed to the former resident who hasn't lived there for 8 years.
Okay.
So those kind of things, you know, it's like they're never going to find these. And this is not, you know, and this is not a neighborhood where, you know, where folks are moving in and out mm-hmm. every year or two. I mean, so, you know, you're just not going to find these folks just by mailing them things to their last known address. Most of these folks have moved once or twice probably since then. And they're, you know, probably are a little more efficient ways to do it.
I mean, in some ways, Ohio has that part of keeping the rolls maintained is a bit crude. You know, because as Jim says, you know, you don't want people on the rolls who voting for Ohio offices that don't live in Ohio mm-hmm. or,
but
you know.
That's
people.
Not really, no one's ever found that to be necessarily the case.
Well, I guess they're trying to be preventive and... Because what you had before the purges, and you know, this is the what the folks in favor of purges, voter purging, would say, you have more registered voters in a county than you do eligible voters because there's lots of deadwood. Obviously, some of these people are literally dead. Some have moved, you know, and they've plugged in with some other state databases. You know, somebody moves in there, you take them off the Ohio rolls, things of that nature. But in the end, how do we know you're no longer an eligible voter? And I say it's crude because right now the device is, you know, if you miss a couple of federal elections, then that starts a mail notice cycle from your county board of elections saying, hey, we haven't heard from you. And you still live there and all that. Mm-hmm. And then you don't reply to a couple of those. You continue not to vote. Then they're saying, okay, we haven't heard from Ann. She hasn't voted. She must not be eligible anymore, so we take you off. So Frank LaRose wants to minimize that from happening. Now, it's minimize, not stop it. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, hopefully to cut the necessity for purging such huge numbers that it's in the hundreds of thousands of people, as we've done recently.
Mm-hmm. And the criticism is that, look, if I decide not to vote for 10 years, that's my right. Why should I be taken off the rolls? Why should I no longer be eligible mm-hmm. Just because I've chosen not to vote? That's the, you know, one of the big arguments against this purging effort is that you haven't done anything wrong. to and make yourself ineligible. You just not participated, and you have that right to not participate if you don't want to until you decide that it's time to participate again.
You didn't unregister. You just didn't vote.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the other side would say, well, that's cool. Don't vote, but send us one of those little notices back to say you're still alive and you're still at that address.
Right.
But again, that's through snail mail these days, and under the new system, if you do it for state, you know, the BMV, you sign up for welfare, any place you touch the state government, they're saying that would improve it.
Darrell Rowland, Columbus Dispatch Public Affairs Editor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Also, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andy Chow, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Reporter, thanks to you as well.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.